Session number 1061, rule 4.
Mr. Charles Burden Taylor, Reel 4. Your original colonel, Colonel Leyburn, had left the battalion, and you'd had a replacement. Ross McLaren had taken over as officer commanding. What do you remember of McLaren during this period before Beard arrived in very early January, or late December, sorry?
Yeah, I don't think there had a great deal of... Well, there wasn't very much time in between, but Ross McLaren was... a most likeable chap, first and foremost, to get the sort of character side straight. He used to do a very good mess act, which we needn't go into at the moment. Perfectly pure. It was very, very clever, because it always brought in all our guests and some of the background, and it was very amusing.
You might as well mention it, did you raise
it? No, I can't. That's what it was, really. And it was really in the way of a song. And but he... I don't know how he found out odd little snippets about each individual guest that came, but he'd go through the lot, and we'd all sing with him and so on, the various choruses. But anyway, that's a sideline, but he had a tremendous sense of humour, but also a very, very solid sense of duty. He was that sort of chap. He, in fact, I suppose his title was a mining engineer, and when one thinks about the dangers, in fact, inherent in mining, particularly in those days, when, shall we say, the regulations weren't as strict, then one can understand that his feelings for efficiency and making sure that nobody would be lost through inefficiency was part of his characteristics.
As I said, he was replaced by Beard in December. What did you think of Beard?
He, at first, it was difficult because, difficult is the wrong word. Here was the only other regular officer we'd seen, really, as far as I was concerned, was Andrew Clark, the adjutant. And here we had another regular coming to, shall we say, take over the job of one of us, of one of our officers. And in a way, he might have started subconsciously with a slight disadvantage from our point of view. But very soon, I was lucky because I was still a company commander, even though with one pip. So that I was in on all the CO's conferences, and in these one very soon got to know that this tall, very quiet new colonel who'd come across from the 2nd Battalion in France was going to be good for us. His attention to detail was tremendous from the point of view of some of the administrative things. He was a great believer in boots, which occasionally he would sort of stretch his legs out under the table with a thump. He was a very quiet man, and thump his feet under the table as he banged the table with his hands, and would, almost at the top of his quiet voice, yell, "Boots, I am not satisfied," or something of that ilk. And, I think we very soon got to realise that he was assumed as the next man, and a damn good CO.
What was the relationship like between the territorial officers and the regular officers overall in this early period of the war?
That's a difficult one because we didn't have very many comparisons to be made. But
you had, I mean, I don't know whether you saw much of Jackie Churchill, but
there were
regulars about.
That is true. I think first and foremost we've got to say we were all scared stiff of Jackie Churchill, and I don't really remember anyone who wasn't.
What was that?
I don't know. There was just something about him that his tremendous stride. He used to walk like a light. Well, he wasn't, anyway, it doesn't matter. But like a hare, if you like. And it's rather like he would be there out in front, we'll say, on toots, and we would always sort of gasping for breath, following him to the next point. Essentially efficient. I think in the early days, that was perhaps the time we worried so much. Because he was always round. The amount of energy he spent going round his brigade was tremendous. and his insistence on standard. And you were scared, Stephen, in case you made a mistake, because you didn't quite recognise that he might be human under this, what can I say, overwhelming efficiency. But anyway, that's Jackie Churchill.
Did you get to, while we're on him, did you get to see the human dimension while you were with them? Or was it the side that you just guessed existed later on?
Well, I think that I was one time relieved, because I was in, as the company commander, I'm sorry to go back to Stanley, but if ever I nearly fainted in my life, I was on the phone to then Brigadier Kirkup, because he took over the second line brigade, and he was worried about getting his driver, who was a THO in my company, but he was also his driver in civilian life. And I was chatting to Brigadier Kirkup on the phone. The door opened behind me in my office, and there stood Jackie Churchill. I didn't know whether I should shut up one brigadier, salute the other, or just, you know, try and get cool. As it was, I sweated it out and said to Brigadier Kirkup, Brigadier Churchill's just arrived, so may I sort of ring back? And I suppose kept my cool, but I don't think I've ever sweated so much in those few seconds. And I think in a way that could have broken a little bit of ice, because Jackie was as mild as anything. How was I getting on? What, you know, really asked me all the questions he should have done. And I felt when I got over that one, we should be all right in the future.
And now widening it back out to regulars, did you think regulars were more competent or more hidebound? Did you have a sort of picture of them as a group, or did you take them as they came?
I think generally one took them as they came. I'm going back to when I was, 18, 19, 20, and I think that was the way. No way would I say that we ever had an inferiority complex or anything like that, because I think basically we were all human. We all spoke within the limits of our ability and the training that we had received. Incidentally, I was lucky enough to have a fortnight at Sandhurst on the TA Subaltern's course before the war, which was very interesting, which helps, of course, in the training background.
What about actual regular troops? Did you think they compared with your territorials?
I don't think I've ever had an occasion to really make a comparison. But I would say that Tim Beard, after he'd been with us, I think, probably 6 weeks or a month, at one of the company commanders' conferences, he said that he wanted to make it clear that he'd come from a regular battalion and as a regular soldier, but in the time that he'd spent with this battalion, that's the 8th battalion, he'd found that there are a tremendous number of aspects of our life and our outlook and training which he wished could be incorporated in the regular army. He didn't actually enumerate a great deal in detail, so I can't really go on that theme. But I think he just wanted to make it clear that we all had a part to play, and we were playing our part extremely well, and that some of the things could rub off very well in the regular service.
Now, in January, you gradually became aware that you were going to be posted to France, and you were posted in late January.
Yep.
What preparations were made for that posting?
Well, the leave, medical side, I think we had to have a final medical just in case anyone was in fact unfit, check relative to people who were either in hospital or likely to go to hospital, the inevitable needles, the jabs, and the one or two of the lads we knew would probably pass out, not literally, but didn't like the idea, so one of course put oneself and one's officers through first, the sergeant major following up, the colour sergeant, then NCOs, then starting with the lads. And that went off all right, in fact. But it was something new to them, because they never had any jabs, or some of them rather, had had this sort of thing before. And then, of course, was leave.
Did everybody get embarkation leave?
Everybody should have got embarkation leave. I don't know that anyone who missed it. And I don't see why they should have done, unless there's something. No, not embarkation leave. They might have missed going if they'd fallen sick or something like that on leave, or when they arrived back. But other than that, it was packing up, rechecking our kit, making sure that we had everything we should have, and indenting for anything that was missing, really.
So, were you briefed at all about what you'd find in France?
I don't remember any briefing. I don't honestly remember being told where we might land up. I don't think anything like that happened until we in fact got onto the France.
So, well, how did the journey take place then?
Well, this was about the coldest January, I think, we'd had for years and years and years, and railway points were frozen and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, we got away from Charlbury Station, perishing cold weather, and...
Was there any sort of send-off from the people of the area?
Not that I can recall, in fact. It was a very small station. I'm sure that there could well have been, but I don't remember any question of sort of people in the streets or anything like that. But then Charlbury was a very small town, very small, and Spelsbury, where I think we doubled the population by a company arriving, in fact, more than doubled it.
So you set off from the station?
Yep, and embarked and went through Cherbourg. And I think I'm right in saying that we landed up in Saint-Rémy-du-Plain, which is not all that far away from Le Mans. At that time, I was popped out again away from battalion headquarters with C Company, and there we were living in barns. It's pretty rough, actually, because it was barn accommodation. And the officers were in, I think, an empty house because a certain amount of cold wind used to come in through broken windows. But generally speaking, that was just an area in which we would be staying but for the few days. And then we understood that we'd be then motoring across France up into, I think, the Lille area at that time.
You were billeted in the area. What was the reception from the French? I mean, I know you...
Very little. I think the local estaminet... This was, a very, very small village, and very few people really around the place. I think the greatest reception was at the local estaminet, which basically we couldn't get the whole company in. Mind we packed it out as much as we could. And... we had certain good evenings from the point of view of really having a sort of good old sing-song, from the point of view of having something to do in the evening, the late evening. And, of course, the owners were very, very happy that we should be spending our francs in as liquid a possible, you know, fashion as possible.
You were given francs, where your pay was smoothly converted,
yep.
So to speak.
Yes, yes.
What exactly were you doing while you were at Remy? Were you doing any training?
Oh, no, this training, yes, certainly. And also, I think we did do a little bit of training with... Mind, we'd done this in Oxfordshire as well, this question of training as a motor division, when one had to work out various procedures.
What sort of thing do you mean?
Well, the main thing is that a thing that we'd never heard of was an embussing point and a debussing point and that sort of thing. And how would we debuss... from the point of view, if you've got a battalion, which is overall some 900 to 1,000 men, all ranks, you can't just debus if you've been travelling at such and such a space between vehicles. So one had really to sort of study the sort of bus stop principle, if you like, that we would go to an area and then either disperse at dispersal points, which we'd never heard of, but, well, we had in England, and then we'd get to debussing points, and there were just some little new schemes, new deployment drills, I think that's the best way of putting it, which was commensurate with being moved about by lorry.
So you were all in lorries. What kind of lorries were they?
Three ton, yeah. With our usual, we had our own 1500 weights and 1300 weight Cook's wagon and so on.
And how long were you at Remy? You didn't stay there, same Remy. You didn't stay there long, though.
No. That I don't know, because it couldn't have been, I don't think, more than a couple of weeks, I'd have thought, if that.
And then where?
And then Bayeux was one, but we went, in fact, shall we say, just across France, up to the Lille area. And then I would get slightly hazy, and that's why I'm looking for this PW book, because there I have actually traced the individual stopping points. But we're getting up to this, I think, the Lille area.
Do you remember any the period at Wassy? In the Wassy area, that's near Amiens.
Yeah. That's not coming straight off the top of my head, so I can't...
Fair enough. So you were let's leave it loose then. You were moving through France and training as you went at various spots?
No, because we in fact stayed overnight at a spot and then straight into our lorries and off the following morning. In other words, it was, well, not non-stop, but we had trading halts for a meal and an overnight rest. I suppose it probably 3 points... between Saint-Rémy and Amiens. Sorry, not Amiens, Lille. I think Lille came first.
Now, when did your brother left the battalion?
He'd already left.
There's a reason why he left. Could you just explain why he'd gone?
Yes, I didn't know this, actually, until after the war, but he was commanding A Company when we were at in Oxfordshire. And suddenly off he went to the 2nd Battalion on an exchange basis, and Captain John Dixon came from the 2nd Battalion and took over my brother's company. And it wasn't until after the war that I understood that the reason he'd volunteered for this swap was that he didn't want to be in a position whereby he might have to send me out on a rather dodgy patrol or a dangerous mission or whatever you like to call it, and rather than pull the big brother act and tell me to go and jump in the river or jump somewhere else, he volunteered to leave the battalion, which I think was a great wrench, because his chums were still there, Walter Goodenough, Johnny Walton and Jack Rain and others, and I think it was a jolly nice thing to do.
You didn't stay in command of C Company. Officer commanding.
No.
What happened there? Who took?
Johnny Walton came up. I think it was just before we left Saint-Rémy du Plain, moving up towards Lille, that Johnny Walton took over, and I became second in command of C Company.
And where did you finally settle? What's the next stage?
The next stage, I think, might be Seclair, but I would really have to check this out.
Do you remember Gondecourt at all?
Yes. We were digging anti-tank. I think this is... this is all about the same time anyway, digging the anti-tank ditches. But Seclair was surely, I think, my C Company's location when the battalion headquarters was at Gondecourt at that time.
You were digging anti-tank ditches there. What exactly was the process that you were... How did you go about it?
Don't forget, we had virtually a battalion of Durham miners, so there was no hesitation about getting dug in or getting stuck in or whatever you'd like to call it. But no, really, the thing had to be paced out. We were guided by the engineers, and the thing had to be paced out. And really, what it amounted to was, a sort of V-shaped or an L-shaped wedge in the ground with the vertical face. I suppose you might call it a bent L, but the vertical face being down to the depth, I would say, about 14 feet. Might not, that's two of me, isn't it? No, it might be less than that, perhaps 10 feet. But the main thing was that it was a ditch facing the enemy, or the proposed possible enemy approach line, and he would just tipple forward or slide forward into this, come up against the so-called brick wall, and that was an anti-tank ditch. And it was really, having had it paced out by the engineers or measured out, then we would get cracking indeed.
The miners, I presume, didn't have too... It was an easy job for them.
Oh, we didn't have any mechanical... Oh, it's an easy job because of their, shall we say, expertise with a shovel. And... But there weren't any, to my knowledge, any sort of mechanical diggers or anything like that.
Do you think that's why they were picked to do that? Because of the...
No, I think that this was something that everybody was doing.
And these were reserve lines, weren't they?
Well, No, they were very near the frontier from memory. And I think the main point at that time was that the Maginot Line didn't go right up to the coast. And really, we were preparing an extension of that. This is as I read it. And so it was essential that everybody got stuck in at any point in that line to produce a defence against any tank attack.
Now, before the you actually went on leave very early in
May. That's right, yes.
Can you tell me about that? Because that's just at the time that...
Yes, so that we went through... Yes, went back through Boulogne and over and came back to Newcastle, family up here, and I think the big thing that I recall was in the local Eldon. It's still open now, but not as an old Eldon restaurant as it was then. Coming over the air that Chamberlain had resigned, and we'd already heard, I think, that the 10th of May, that the attack had started after the phony war, and that Chamberlain had resigned and Churchill had taken over. And the whole of the Eldon restaurant just went off into hoots of cheers and clapping and so on, on the basis, I suppose, now we're going to get something done.
So Churchill was a popular figure even then?
Oh, very much so. Well, before the war, he was very much warning and warning and warning again of the German threat. That was it. In fact, before the war, unless I'm sure I'm not mistaken, but we were still negotiating some form of treaty with Italy. On the other hand, just round about this time, the Amiens time, we had the whole of 50 division officers up to a massive meeting when we were briefed about what was going on. And when question time came, somebody asked the question and said, you know, do we want to have Italian, you know, Italy in the war on our side? And General Martel very quickly said, not likely, because we'd immediately have to send two divisions off to the Brenner Pass. And which was such as the, shall we say, the opinion of the Italian fighting man. Good in other ways, but not a true soldier, I don't think.
So you were in this restaurant when you heard of the of Churchill taking over. Were you called back off your leave because of the German offensive, or did you
no,
go back normally?
No, we just went back normally, and I think went out from Southampton and to, once again, to Cherbourg. And then it was a question of getting on to trains, French railways again, or not again, because we motored across the previous time. And I'm not quite sure what the area was, but at some time we detrained, and I was given charge of a group of, oh, just a multitude of people from all sorts of regiments, and don't make my way somewhere, but on the way there I saw my own battalion's vehicles pulling through, and I thought, well, if my battalion is as close as this, surely I might be allowed to. And anyway, I made the representations and was allowed to go back to my battalion, which I did, just having missed my brother, which was rather a pity. He'd been wounded with 2nd battalion, and he was on his way back to UK.
So this was during the forced march from Grammont back towards the Arras area?
That's correct.
Somewhere between the 18th and 19th of May, I presume?
That would be... Yes, that would be about it, because the 10th when they started... I think I'd got halfway through my leave at that time.
What condition have you had anything happened to the battalion while you've been away that had caused any?
No, as far as I understand it, they had gone up into Belgium, and then in effect had to withdraw, and as it turned out, to withdraw in preparation to of the tank, the infantry tank attack with. In the Arras area.
What do you remember of that period then? Because you were moving up towards Vimy Ridge and prior to the Arras attack.
Yeah.
What do you remember of that whole thing in sequence, as far as you're concerned? You were second in command of C Company.
C Company, that's right. And
presumably, therefore, were you actually a platoon commander?
No, I was actually second in command.
That
is part of your order establishment of company commander and second in command and three platoon commanders. No, I really rejoined C Company with Johnny Walton, and off we went to Vimy Ridge, and where we got ourselves undercover, rechecked everyone, had the usual sort of change of clothing, socks, checking out, as you would do anything, really, that everyone was there and everyone in good order. We were dive bombed at that time. This was really basically the first sort of personal action which I had experienced.
What was your reaction to the Stuka dive bombing attack?
It was fascinating the way these things, you know, had come down. I think the most fascinating side was that they were not as bad. We'd seen them before, but never close to, and they weren't really as bad as one imagined they would be. I think that's the best point. But the one thing that I had at that time, because obviously we were going to go into some action, was that I'd never really seen a good sort of motor smash pre-war, or a lot of blood. And my great fear was that I might be sick or whatever one does, break down, or whatever that means. The first time I saw anyone, you know, stiff on the roadside or something like that. And so in a way, that shall we say, the combination of being rather fascinated by these things coming down, and they didn't seem to really cause as much damage as you thought they might.
Did the siren work at all on you? It was meant to cause a morale effect, the noise they made.
The following day, slightly worrying, because this was after we'd gone up from Vimy and to do this Arras attack, and when we'd had to withdraw back to Vimy. And I remember coming back in my own, I had 1,500 weight, I think, then. And behind me was a carrier, and when we went on to cobbles, the track of the carrier had a very much not dissimilar noise from the screeching on the, you're talking about the bombs and the wings, and that grated a bit. I felt, you know, I could do without that carrier behind me. I didn't go racing over the hills to get away from it.
What sort of positions did you take up on the Vimy Ridge prior to the attack? What sort of defensive positions were you in? Were you in the old trenches?
No, we weren't actually in any trenches at all on Vimy. We were just dispersed within the wooded area until we pulled out to a footmarch up to this Arras attack. And that's where I saw the first, because from other sources you'll have heard that the tanks came over a crest on a transverse road was Jerry Collin, and they just, you know, lambasted into them, and there was a lot of blood and guts lying about, where there's certain mutilation from the tank's point of view, for that matter, over dead bodies and so on. And I was surprised that I felt all right, but that was a severe, funnily enough, one never, at least I didn't feel that one was ever going to be bumped off. I think that I wouldn't have liked to have lost a leg or an eye or whatever, but at first this worry just about being sick or puking, and as it happened later on, it was more my chaps that puked up, not funnily enough because of nasty sights, but going past shot up animals, which were really stinky, so it was more a simple tummy complaint rather than any other reason.